Welcome to the Sheffield Humanist meeting. A little bit of a complication. We've just been sorting out a projector this evening. We had a complication on that. We have a slightly different meeting this evening. We have three. Usually we just have one speaker and the discussion. This time we have three speakers taking two different points of view on the subject, clean coal. Some people ask why we have sort of meetings like clean coal for the humanists. Well, quite simply, if we get it wrong, we either land up with not enough energy, which is going to affect an awful lot of people, or we're going to land up with longer-term climate damage. And in both cases, I think that as human beings, let alone humanists, we have a responsibility to people in this country, people in other countries, and people in the future. So that, to me, is the context that we're working in. So who we have this evening are Terry Fox, President of NACODS, that's the National Association of...
Colliery Government Deputies and Shortfires.
And Shortfires, lovely. who's also a former Sheffield councillor. For our particular purposes, he is a member of the Trade Union Council Clean Coal Task Group, and he's also a member of the Campaign for Secure Energy, which is supporting clean coal, nuclear and renewable energy as security on energy. I'm sure you can explain more if you need to.
Okay.
Alongside him we have Jenny Patient, who I have known for a long time, basically representing the Sheffield Campaign Against Climate Change. She is also active on a large number of other bodies and organisations. I won't take up the meeting's time to go through them all, if you don't mind. And Anne Harris, who has been organising Coal Caravan, which, not really quite a caravan since you're cycling. I haven't seen many. I don't fancy pulling a caravan when I'm cycling. Basically, looking at open cast communities in Nottinghamshire and so on. And you may well have come across these on the web and so on. We've had a little discussion, and Terry is going to present the case for clean coal. Be about 15 minutes. After that, Jenny and Anne will present the case against clean coal. And then we're going to open it up to a discussion. And basically, I'll give a little bit more detail when we come to this discussion, but we're trying to get as many people as we can involved. So that does mean, basically speaking through the chat, I'll acknowledge you, and then I'll just say, come and speak. So we'll sort that out nearer the discussion time. So if I can start off with Terry, get you a screen back. And this is yours. Okay.
Thank you, David. Good evening. Do you mind if I sit down or stand up? Is there a preference? I'm not that good looking, but if you want to see me that much, I'll stand up. But obviously, with technology, I just like to sit down. As Dave says, my name's Terry Fox. I'm the president of NACODS. It's the Pit Supervisors Union. For most people, anybody who knows about the union, you've got your NUM, which is kind for your mine workers. You've got NACODS for the supervisors, and Backham is for management, but depending which type of scale you come from. I'm hoping that's... So I'm going to kick off, first of all, by a little statement, and most people will know what the statement is. To know where we're going, we must remember where we came from. And I've got to go back, because within my introduction, I'll come to you that I've over 30 years in the mining industry. I've worked underground for 30, and I've two as president now of NACODS. And going back when I first started, and it's in a dirty word, we had nationalisation. We had National Coal Board. I'm not going to go into the arguments tonight whether that's right, wrong or indifferent, or why they got rid of nationalisation. But the one point I want to dwell on about nationalisation was that it allowed a department of the Coal Board to have a research and development department. And in that process, back in the 1980s, we had a clean coal power station up, ready for running, a village not far from here called Grimethorpe. Fluid bed, desulfurisation, plant ready to go, and we led, unashamedly, we led the world in advanced technology on coal. But as we all know, back in the 80s, and my wife's here today to vouch for it, that we lived on chips and egg for a year. But when we went back to work, they got rid of the pits, and we're left now with about 9 deep mine pits within the UK. So just going on for that, just 2 quick flick sessions just to nip you through the situation. That's a modern mining machine cutting coil, and that's at Thoresby Colliery. There we got, when my father were in pits, and he used to say, with that low, he used to have to take flatfish for his snap, but I'm not having that. But that's when he used to work on props and bars, and that was actually in a pit not far from us called Orgreave, which was just up the road. That's a modern face, ready for the face machine to go up and down. Where you would walk now, that advances as the coils tuck in front by the cutting machine. Those powered supports, £1 million a piece, would be advanced hydraulically, and the whole operation is gone again. And that's basically our every pit in the country now is worked with a machine that cuts through, and you can see just above him, there's the powered supports that hold the roof up, and he mines through that. These are the new modern, what they call JCM, they're the mining machines with great big picks. That's because they were obviously to cut coil, which we call thermal coil, which is what the ones that go to the power station to be mined. And they're the lads at front of machine, they're putting in the roof supports, which are, as we call them, as roof bolts. And if you look at, as we call it roof, some might call it the ceiling, but if you look in the ceiling, that's where the rams go up to the roof and the drills put in the drilling rig. That's just showing you 2 fat blokes meeting at a meeting station, and that's a good looking bunch of miners, and I'm not told he was in front there. That's just quick a rifle through just to get you a taste of the underground works where we are. And onto, and that's Maltby Colliery with our works last off from 94 to 2007. Right, what's the challenge then for coil? Well, as we know, it's keeping the power on is half of it, and the other half is obviously reducing greenhouse emissions. And all that is done in the context of a security of supply. Because let's not kid ourselves on here, that we do know, and these are government figures, we do know that the lights will dim by 2015. We do know that the world needs, and it will need, 50% more power by 2030. And the UK emissions in that big bubble of a global bubble is 2%. That's not saying us a bit lightly. That's not saying that we should not take our commitments lightly. But that's where we sit in this global atmosphere of where we are. Obviously, within that, we have our energy mix. Now, each side, in all of them, in all the renewables, in all the gas, nuclear, oil, each side has its advocates, each side has its, shall we say, raspberry blowers, and we have a look at it of pantomime dames, because there ain't one right answer. Unfortunately, there ain't one right answer, and I'm not here to knock any one of them. I'm here to say that coal has got a place within our country to provide the base load fuel for us. Then whatever springboards in the medium term from that must be with a green badge. And we believe that clean coal now is the new kid on the block. We believe it's the way forward for this country to maintain its base load electricity to give all the population the chance to feed its need for power. No matter where we look now, the population needs that power. So if you just have a quick look there, there's one I've missed off, and I'm sure somebody might pull it up, but it is solar. It's not because of anything really, but it just here. So nuclear, if we can just go to nuclear for a quick thing. Nuclear, 1956, looking around, I think some of you remember that, when the Queen opened Calder Hall. She stood there, pulled the lever, the first nuclear power station in the world. She said that it was the greatest contributions to human welfare, and that energy would be that cheap, we won't be able to meter it. Bless her. What next? We all know what next is, don't we? We all know the debate will not be around nuclear power. The debate will be around nuclear waste and what we do with nuclear waste. Because unfortunately, signs and symptoms coming out from the government is that nuclear is the way forward once again. But we'll see about that. Clean coal, gas and oil. Well, gas and oil in the news lately through the Falklands. A new big oil field found. The way forward is out there with the oil. Government figures say 2020 UK to increase import capacity by 15 to 30%. Deals to be done with places such as Middle East, the Russia, North Africa and Iran. How do we make these deals? What's kind of going to be the order? Just phone up and put us next week's order in? No, what's this deal going to be with these geopolitical unstable states? How are we going to maintain? And to produce electricity with gas, I cannot think what is the worst thing we could do with a natural resource within this country. It's only this last, 3 months where we've had to shut businesses down and cut gas supplies off to them to maintain to where we go. And the bidding war has now been described by Christine Butley in the Times as pricing shock, because that is what's going to go. The days of cheap gas have gone. The dash for gas is gone. So where do we go from there? Well, the government says it's renewables, kid. That's what they say. That's the way forward. It's renewables. But there's a bigger conflict in renewables than we've got anywhere. And that is the biggest problem us in the coal industry face. Now, I know that might sound daft from this platform, but it does. It stops us driving forward, because at the moment, the government's got its knickers in a twist in between who it's listening to and what they're listening. And I'm not trying to belittle that argument, but that's where we are. Because if you look at it, 15% of our electricity from renewables by 2015, 60% by 2050, and groups, wind groups, are arguing the case. Is it onshore, is it offshore wind? We know around here, in Peniston alone, we had that big battle about whether we should put windmills up or should we not. The debate is, are they ugly? The Campaign for Rural England states it's industrialisation of our land. Well, is it, isn't it? We've got wind and we've got tidal. Well, wave v biomass. Biomass with population exploding in the world. Are we actually going to take the land plot that we use for food out to grow fuel for the power stations, or are we not? The debate's got to be had, and we have a certain control over that to take that. And obviously, the Lotteners are all against nuclear anyway. So we need to find out where we're going. Because within that, the coldest day, proven fact in 2009, was the 5th of January, and production of electricity from renewables was just 35% of their capacity. The base load was met, once again, by coal. Why? Because the gas of the 2 day supply that we had within the gas had to be held off because of the imports. So about coal then. Well, as we told you, it's the base load fuel. When we need that day, that moment, Coronation Street, whatever, turn switch on, you need that electricity for that kettle, it is fueled by coal. That is a fact. We burn about between 50 to 60 million tonnes. Unfortunately, 40 million tonnes is imported, and we've got about between 10 to 18 million tonnes, if we're having a good year, within our coal fuel. UK coal-fired power stations by 2015, due to the European legislation on large combustion plant directive, says that they are only allowed to burn X number of hours if they do not fit scrubbing, fluidised, desulfurised beds, or they actually fit the kind of bolt fit these hoods to them. And a lot of, shall we say, the power generators, God bless them, the French, the Germans, or within our utilities, and we come back to where nationalisation of utilities were, I said, well, we're not bothered. We'll carry on burning, we'll burn to 2015, we'll burn as hours, and then we'll shut shop. Well, that doesn't do anybody any favours at all. Because the government says that the market will be met by private company, private money, and that we should work within the market. Marvellous. Market designed by the Tories, by the way. But where we were on that is obviously that we have to look at ways of working within clean coal. And that's not just in this country. As I say, it's just 2% within this country of our bubble. But let's look what's happening globally. Coal burn is increasing. And who are we after going through our industrial revolution, say, to the Chinese and to the Indians, you can't grow as fast as us unless you do it green. Oh, I'm sorry, kid, that ain't going to happen. They have already demanded, and it's already shown on trading figures, that their electricity and steel is to increase between 7 to 8% in the next 5 years, which is driving up the price of coal on the market between 70 to 160, that's for the thermal, and the China's thirst for coal, and it was staggering that I read it myself, was around 38 million tonnes for August. For August. India may be short of about 200 million tonnes by 2015, so they are going to burn. They are building power stations as we speak, continuing to be coal-fired, and we are missing a trick. In this country, we had the technology. We was at the leading edge of that technology, of which we could have sold, we could have competed with the world forces, and we could have made a real difference. But we're having to play catch-up again. There's about five plants around the world that's up and running with what we call carbon capture storage. And because of the price of this technology, it's actually looking at our own, on our doorsteps, at Hatfield, just up the road. The technology has been awarded £140 million from European money to build a clean-fuelled power station that could open another two pits, that one is mothballed down the road at Arworth, that could reopen the coalfields but burn cheaply. And on the top of that, if you look at the Yorkshire and Humber area around Drax, around Ferrybridge, around Edinburgh, in them areas, one of the most highly concentrated carbon capture storage is basically looking at ways that we can actually take it at source, take it on a pipeline, take it through the developed area and put it into the coal into the oil fields in the North Sea, and actually use that to force out the remaining oil, but actually to store it. Now, I've heard all sorts of stories about we can't do that. It's impossible to do, it's not the way forward. It's technology has been run at this moment in time. What I'm pushing is that we should be a major player on that stage, and it should be the government of the day that takes that firm action, because the market forces aren't going to do it unless carbon trading prices goes up. If carbon trading prices goes up, the price for heating fuel will go up. And we get into a vicious circle, and the only people that's going to pay is us, the consumers, again. This project is being run by Regional Development Agency at Yorkshire Forward. They are looking, well, they're not looking, they're actually developing at this moment in time to bolt on into this great pipeline, to bolt on to actual the steelworks at Scunthorpe and at Stocksbridge, to look at ways of channeling their carbon into it and to store it deep underground. He has stated that it will protect over 55,000 quality long-term jobs. And at the end of the day, to look at our situation the way we are, that's where we need to be. Because green jobs is the badge of which the government is looking at, is their terminology, which they're walking behind by pushing forward these, shall we say, think tank targets, because they believe that the targets that they put forward would have been knocked down by the French, by the Germans and the European, and it wasn't. It was held up and said that's the way forward, and government source at this moment in time is behind meeting their targets for 2020. And so we still have to look at ways of being able to use and burn coal, not only in this country, around the world, with the technology that we've got beneath our feet, and we've only used 25% of the coal that we've got. And if you thought of all the actual emissions that we get from shipping, etc., is a different way forward totally. So that's a quick gallop through clean coal, but we are the new kid on the block. We are fighting back because we believe we've got a role to play in this energy market, Only short to medium term, we're aware of that, but we believe that we can burn coal cleanly. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. Okay, Dave, thanks. Right. As Dave's introduced us, myself and Anne here, sort of under the banner of Sheffield Campaign Against Climate Change and the Coal Caravan, we think that clean coal, aka clean coal, so-called clean coal, by which we mean carbon capture and storage, really, and the process around that, is a misguided approach to addressing climate change. And it's an approach which will encourage more coal use. Can you hear me at the back there, by the way?
Yeah.
Cause ecological destruction and human suffering, generate huge risks for the future, and legitimise business as usual thinking. So what we're going to do is we're going to start off with the climate science and what that's saying about how much fossil fuel we can use, go on to look at what so-called clean coal means, and then look at the problems and risks, and why it's very much a cross your fingers approach, and in fact an act of faith. Thanks, Dave. So this is starting from the climate science. These are some figures on the known reserves of coal, gas and oil are in the world. So in other words, that's the total global reserves, of, the amount that's known to exist in the form that we could use. And you can see it's dominated by coal. The final column there is how much carbon it contains. So in other words, that's sort of how much fuel potential it's got, but also how much potential it's got to create CO2 and greenhouse gas. And what is interesting is that the figures that have been published in Nature recently say that out of that 818 billion tonnes, we can only... If we burn a third of those between now and 2050, we're taking ourselves to a risk, a 25% risk, of causing 2 degrees of global warming. So, in other words, that's where your safe limit is. Your safe limit might be that you can burn a third of that between now and 2050. It's not particularly safe. It'd be safe if we burnt less, and that's not taking into account a lot of other greenhouse gases that we're creating as well. So you can see that the fact that coal is abundant, which it certainly is, has stopped being the main argument, really. The main argument now has to be how much of that can we actually afford to burn without actually wrecking our planet and making it a hell to live on. So the only reason why that has ever been given, really, for developing carbon capture and storage is that coal is abundant and it's cheap. And that therefore we should find ways to use it. Of course, you can see those figures and you can understand that there are major industries, as Terry sort of described for us in a way, that the history of those and of the exploitation of those resources means there are huge industrial concerns which have an interest in that carrying on and actually carrying on using those resources. Whereas for renewables, it doesn't have that kind of interest that's already there, speaking with one voice. So just to reiterate, the imperative has got to be climate safety, and that's the world we're in at the moment. So let's have a look at carbon capture and storage and see whether that helps us with this. Thanks. So that's a kind of schematic diagram of roughly what it's about. Roughly what it's about is... when we have industrial processes or power stations or things, as Terry said, like steel making or cement as well, that we can capture the CO2 and then we can put in a pipeline and put it typically into somewhere we've dug other fossil fuels out of. And that's the sort of basic idea. If you go on to the next slide again, Dave, it's the three kinds of CCS that are being talked about work in three different ways. So we've got the idea that you take coal before you burn it, and you gasify it and separate it out into hydrogen, which you can then burn as a fuel, and you've got the CO2 as the other component, which you can then store. Post-combustion scrubbing, so in other words, this is the sort that you can kind of like put something onto your existing power station and use chemicals to actually get the CO2 out of the exhaust gases, if you like, the gases that come out of the combustion. Or oxy-fuel combustion, which is the least developed of these three approaches, which is basically where you have to burn your coal in pure oxygen. So as you can imagine, you've got quite an expensive process to actually get pure oxygen in the first place and use that to burn it in. And each of these methods will reduce the efficiency of the power station. So in other words, you will get if you've got a quarter less efficient power station, you have to use a third more coal than you would in a normal power in its equivalent without CCS. So one of the major factors is that if you start to do this, you start to have to dig up more coal and use more coal. The elements of these technologies, some of them exist and some of them don't exist, or some of them at the research or demonstration phase. None of it has been operationalised anywhere as a way of dealing with coal. It has been used in taking out excess CO2 from natural gas in order to make the natural gas saleable, and that CO2 has been used to for what's called enhanced oil recovery, which is it's been pumped, as Terry described, actually it's been pumped into oil wells, and it squeezes the last bit of more out the toothpaste tube. Really, it sort of enables you to get more out of your oil field. But if you look at how that compares with for coal, there's the Sleipner field in Norway, which has been doing this. It's minuscule compared to what would be required for CCS for coal. If you took 1,000 of those projects, it would deal with 4% of your carbon dioxide from coal. That's the kind of level that it's been, the way it needs to scale up. The timescales that people are predicting for this to actually be integrated and brought mature to the market, Massachusetts Institute of Technology say that the first commercial CCS will take until 2030. The Edison Electrical Institute, which is a group of large US power generators, say that commercial deployment for large coal-burning power stations will require 25 years of R&D and cost about £20 billion. Shell said it doesn't foresee CCS being widespread until 2050. The UK government is a bit more upbeat, and they say we won't have a viable system until at least 2020. In fact, the figures they give mean that what they'll have in place just after 2020 would capture about 1.5% of Drax emissions. I mean, Drax is a large local power station. So it's not exactly at scale at that point. But by 2030, it could be used to generate at least one-third of electricity in Britain. So you can see they're quite ambitious. And meanwhile, they're talking about building unabated coal power stations. And just last week, in fact, the Labour Party in government defeated an amendment calling for emissions performance standards on all new power stations, and arguing that this would harm investment in new coal power stations. Their priority is to get those coal stations built, although they have said they agree with the Committee on Climate Change, which is the independent body, that there will be a limited role for unabated coal in the 2020s. So they do see that there's an issue, but they still seem to be steaming ahead towards new coal. When we look at just think whether I want the next slide. Yes. I'll work up towards that one. It's important to look at the whole life cycle of using coal, not just focus on the power station and call the power station clean. And Anne's going to give quite a lot more information about some aspects of that life cycle. But an example is that BP proposed a project to build a a pre-combustion power station, which would capture 26 million tonnes of CO2. That sounds quite good, doesn't it? Use it to extract an extra 40 million barrels of oil from the Miller oil field. But when that was burnt, that would produce another 13 million tonnes of CO2. So if you look at how it's, you know, the proposal as a whole, it's not actually saving all that much CO2. When it's burnt, coal produces three times its own weight of CO2. That comes as a shock because we think, oh, coal's heavy stuff and gas is light stuff, but that's the kind of quantity of stuff you're going to have to be transporting around the, and compressing and putting into storage at very high pressures. And then a very detailed analysis by a guy called Peter Wiebahn from the German Aerospace Centre estimates that CCS will reduce greenhouse gas emissions from coal-fired power stations by a little more than two-thirds. Whereas if you compare that with renewable technologies, they have about 1-4% of the life cycle emissions that burning unabated coal does. So it's the difference between reducing it by 70% and reducing it by 96-99%. And Wiebahn also makes the very obvious point that if, I take Terry's point, maybe producing electricity from gas isn't the best thing to do with it, but by making power stations combine heat and power, you can actually achieve the same kind of efficiency improvements. You can improve it from like throwing away two-thirds of the energy, which is what a typical power station does, to making it much more efficient and saving pretty much the same amount as you would save if you had CCS sometime in the future. And that's the technology that's understood and available right now. And these are two scenarios for Germany, which Wiebahn compares. And the eco one is a maximum investment in energy efficiency and renewables. And the CCS max, as its name suggests, is sort of maximising your investment in your push on CCS. Now, the important thing about this graph is the area that's the dark green colour, because that is the unabated fossil fuels being burnt over that period of time, the same period of time, and how much the emissions they produce would be proportionate to the amount that's being burnt. So you can see that the area overall on the left is much smaller. And that is the important thing for climate change, is how much total CO2 we're putting in the atmosphere. And that is you can see the difference in that graph. So it's not about where you get to, and the fact that you've got this nice light green line on the graph on the right, which enables you to stop having to turn the lights out sometime after 2050, I think it is, or 2030, maybe it is. But the amount of CO2 that you're actually putting in the atmosphere in the interim. Okay, so there's different people saying different things about CCS. People like the Institution of Mechanical Engineers, Institution of Chemical Engineers, think it's going to be good business and Britain should get on with it and do it. But the Zero Carbon Britain report, for instance, looks at a different way we could actually address our energy issues, and says if we had a 20-year programme addressing the energy use, domestic energy use in Britain, in 25 million homes, we could reduce their energy use by 57% in 20 years. And that would produce in itself a load of jobs. It would need a lot of investment, again, of money, science, jobs. But it would actually give a result, and a known result, within 20 years. And, you know, within that time scale as well.
Okay, so Jenny's looked a little bit more at the science behind it and how we're going to cover an energy gap. What I want to look at is the whole picture. Okay, so we can talk about clean coal and CCS, but coal starts polluting from the moment it's removed from the ground. Okay, and it continues to do so whilst it's removed from the ground, whilst it's transported to where it's burnt, and where it's stored. Okay, so there's problems throughout that. We also need to look beyond carbon dioxide. The problem is one of, is an ecological problem, it's a problem of jobs, it's a problem of livelihood, and it's a problem of access to land. So to continue on the idea of storage, the actual storage of CO2 is a white herring. We're not storing the CO2. We don't want the CO2. We have very little use for carbon dioxide. We're dumping it. We're dumping it out of sight. We're talking about dumping it in depleted oil fields. We're talking about dumping it at the bottom of the sea. Okay? So it's dumping. It's not actually storage. The technology to store the CO2 for hundreds and thousands of years, indefinitely, doesn't exist. We haven't yet stored carbon dioxide indefinitely. So we don't know that we can actually do this. So what we're creating is a situation which will affect our children, our grandchildren, our grandchildren's grandchildren, because they're going to have to deal with the legacy of CO2 as well as the legacy of nuclear. So nuclear and CCS are not actually that different. There's been a research project which claims to be the first CO2 measuring and monitoring and verification initiative in Canada, I believe. The length of the study is a mere 10 years. This is the Wyburn Middledale project. So they're looking at how long they can how they can store CO2 for 10 years. That really isn't long enough. Fred Pearce from the New Scientist who also works for The Guardian points out that a leakage rate of 0.01%, which is suggested to be the industry standard, would see almost two-thirds of the CO2 released back into the atmosphere within 10,000 years. Might seem like a long time, but talking geological timescales, it's not that long. It's going to be seeping back out, and that's probably the highest standard we're going to ask for. We're talking about taking carbon dioxide and using that to take out more oil. So we can burn more oil and put more fossil fuels and put more CO2 into the atmosphere. This is the only method of CCS that's currently in operation. We know this works, but we don't know that it stores it or dumps it very well. There isn't actually any evidence that I can find, that I've looked extensively, to see how well it stores the CO2. It does release the make the oil be released, but it doesn't necessarily store the CO2 very well. Some scientists, from it was reported in the Geology magazine, point out possible danger of storing CO2 in the formations of flooded seawater, which is where the oil has come out, basically, because they're currently flooded with seawater. It's believed that the seawater will be acidified and dissolve the metal oxide minerals in the rock in which the CO2 is stored, which could cause releases of CO2 into the ocean. It's also thought by other scientists that the CO2 might actually cause a cap in the rock. So it's just not known what result that will have. If we store CO2 at the bottom of the sea, which is another method of piping it down to the bottom of the sea where it will become a liquid lake in high pressure, we're destroying ecological systems that we don't understand, that we don't know what impact they have. If that CO2 starts to seep into the water, we're going to start acidifying the seas. If we acidify the seas by really small degrees, we kill off the plankton. Kill off the plankton and we kill off the seas to a great extent that we already have. Wherever we're storing this CO2, we have to think about the possibility of release. In 1986, 1,700 people were killed in Cameroon when CO2, which was dissolved in a lake, was released. The CO2 was naturally occurring in the lake because of volcanic eruptions underneath the lakes in the area. This, a cubic kilometre of CO2 was released, killing 1,700 people. It was thought to be released maybe because of a volcanic eruption or an earthquake, or because cold rain poured down one side of the lake and caused a flip in the lake and released this CO2. So it had massive impacts on people. Okay, so if we look at the beginning of the coal, we're going to take it out of the ground. If we take it out of the ground in this country, the main method used by UK Coal and HJ Banks is open cast coal mining. At present, there's more than 33 open cast coal mines in this country. They take off the surface of the ground, then they dig up the coal, releasing particulate matter into the atmosphere. Can you put on the first slide, please? can I put on the next slide? Okay, so releasing particulate matter into the atmosphere so that people who live in the area start to suffer from the sorts of diseases that miners used to suffer from in deep pit mines. As you take off the topsoil, you're releasing this particulate matter that causes all sorts of lung disease in particular, such as a chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. This diagram compares places, top one, the top line being Douglasdale, where there's five current open cast coal mines working. The next sign down is Dalmellington, which is an old coal mining area, where people have suffered from health problems because of the coal mine. The next line down is the UK average, and the lower one is a nice seaside town in a similar area, but it's a similar population, so that's the standard. Okay, that's what you would expect in this area if it wasn't for the coal mines, so that's really low. However, in Douglasdale, the more they're open casting, the worse the health of the people is becoming. This has been looked at quite extensively by the Douglasdale Coal Health Study, the Douglasdale edition of the Coal Health Study, which states that asthma and hypertension have gone up 44%, hyperthyroidism is up 80%, cancer over 250% in the past 4 years. So this is having a massive impact on the people who live in this part of the world. So if we can go back a slide. Sorry. Okay, so the coal seams are concentrated in specific areas in the country. They're concentrated in areas like the central belt of Scotland, is what you can see here. So each of these marks shows the concentration of coal, available, mineable coal in these areas. So they're very localised. There's no problem in the south of the country, for example. Central Scotland has a lot of coal, as does large areas of the northeast of England and Wales. So it's very regionally specific where the coal is. So you get these health problems for the people in those areas. Okay. So 77% of the coal that we burn in this country is imported. Can we go forward two slides? Thank you. Okay, so it's imported. At present, it comes predominantly from Russia and South Africa. There's often a reason behind that we need coal is because of securing energy and securing jobs. Most of the mining jobs happen abroad. We're not actually securing our energy supply because it's coming from Russia, which is where we're worried about our gas supply coming from. So it's not really helping. Increasingly, our coal is coming from Indonesia and Colombia, places with really poor human rights standards. Colombia is a country ravaged by civil war with a reputation of murders of trade unionists and high fatality rates in its mines. The indigenous people in these countries are being removed from their land forcibly by paramilitaries. In Indonesia, a Greenpeace report showed that mining is associated with a long list of negative social and environmental impacts, including forced evictions, conversion of productive farmland, which was used for growing crops, is now being used for open cast mines. Violent police actions to enforce development of mining areas. Destruction of rainforests, accelerating carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gas emissions. Ruining of farmlands, flooding, noise and dust pollution, damage to roads and a lack of political transparency. So worldwide, our thirst for coal, clean or not, is having massive impacts. Okay, so I'll pass on to Jenny just to summarise.
Yes, really just to say our thoughts about the fact that clean coal is an act of faith. It's an act of faith in technology and techno fixes for a problem. And it's assuming that unproven technology that exists as demonstration systems or small-scale systems can be integrated and operationalised. And that can happen over a very fast time scale. It's an act of faith in corporations who are quite keen for this to carry on, who are pushing for state investment, but sometimes, you know, they're not prepared to invest themselves because they can see that unless it's got massive subsidy, it's not really a worthwhile thing to do. It's a faith in market mechanisms, which actually I agree with what Terry said earlier. The UK government is failing to give a clear direction to achieve its strategic aim, which is and should be to decarbonise energy production and to reduce our carbon emissions.
and it prefers to pretend that the market will actually solve the issues. It's faith in continued high consumption and high resource use instead of actually putting a squib behind us to actually find ways to reduce demand and find ways to reduce things. It promises extraction of more oil, for instance. It's an act of faith in coal, because coal is the only fuel that's abundant and cheap enough to make it worth thinking about. And it's locking us into the dirtiest fuel rather than finding ways to leave the dirtiest fuel in the ground. And it's an out of sight, out of mind attitude, putting things into the future, into holes in the ground, hoping that they won't be too much of a problem in 1,000 years time or 100 years time. And it's an act of faith on not doing the sums, really, and looking at what can actually be achieved, and what can be achieved in what time scale, and how, whether it can meet the scale of energy that's needed. So from that point of view, we think, yes, it is an act of faith, and it's not where we should be putting our energy. We should be putting our energy into things that already exist, such as reducing demand and safe, clean renewables. Thank you.
Well, thank you to all of you.
Very good.
Are there many people desperate for the loo?
I won't have a break then, if that's okay. It's a complicated issue, isn't it? It's quite interesting. Yes, we might as well turn the projector off. That's lovely.
That's nice.
Press the power button off, and it'll just go on to stand there. That's lovely. It's complicated. There's jobs involved. There's a faith in various types of technology. There's a lot of faith in renewables as well. So we do have a lot of faith in technologies. And some of the timescales are interesting. So, the way we're going to conduct the next session is basically we're trying to get everyone to discuss rather than just simply ask questions of the speakers. If I think there are some questions which just do need some clarification, if you let me know, and then I'll try to just get you fitted in. What we really want to do is to get you lot discussing what you have heard. What I would do is if you put your hand up if you want to speak, I will then give you an acknowledgement. But then I'll actually ask you to speak when at the appropriate time. It just sort of makes sure that everyone has a reasonable chance. So I have got 4 hands up so far. Hang on just half a sec. I've got to get my piece of paper down so I know who's got hands up. So it's Tony, you. Sorry, it was Tony, Matt. Half a sec. Tony, would you like to start?
Yeah. Well, one of the things I would say is just to enlighten people a little bit about, it's relevant to what Tony was saying. About the base, how the grid system works in this country, with 5 stations on the trains that generate what they call the base load, as Terry said, and they provide the base load 24 hours a day, 365 days a year, and it's a fully integrated system that could, if renewables, whatever energies are used to feed into this system, they could supplement the base load system. But it's going to be a I personally am in favour of renewable energy. I'm dead against nuclear, completely and utterly against nuclear power, always have been all my life. I'm not sure if I'm against coal or not, but the point is, whatever system we use, in July at Worthley Hall, there was a discussion there, again given by Anne Scargill was one of the speakers, and various other speakers from the coal industry and from the renewable industry. And they said that there is no chance, I think it said, by 2050, the demand for electricity will go up by approximately 300%. And there's no way that renewables can meet that demand. So there's got to be a mix of energy. So I think that's something that we all ought to bear in mind. I agree with renewable energy, It's a marvellous idea. There's no pollution, no CO2 produced. It's obviously a marvellous idea. But according to what I've been told and what I've read about it, it is impossible for it to meet our demands fully. So there's got to be a mix of energies.
Thank you. Matt?
I think it's unfortunate that most of your arguments, or this is definitely the environmental, about the speculative nature of green coal also apply to renewable energy. There's no place where renewable energy provides the baseline, provides the 24 hours a day, 365 days a year supply, which our nation needs. And there is only one clean thing which will supply that, and that's nuclear. And that is proven. It's got very low CO2 output. As I mentioned, it does have some waste. But it's rather untrue to say it's a similar issue with carbon capture, because the high level radioactive waste is very small. You just need to find a hole in the ground somewhere and put it in. It'll say that it is a political problem. It is not a scientific engineering problem on the scale of carbon capture storage. So renewables, I would say, are every bit as much of an act of faith as nuclear. As clean coal. We need to go for something clean and sustainable for our baseline, and in the foreseeable future, that's nuclear. Hopefully, in 50 years' time, maybe we can get renewables, but not in the short and medium term.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Matt. Don't know your name, but you're next.
Well, basically, both people have touched on nuclear power. Sadly, nuclear power wasn't spoken very much by, wasn't mentioned very much by the speakers. And I think that everyone supports renewables to a certain extent. But the real battle is between clean coal and nuclear, not really clean coal and renewables, because I think, as I've already stated, everyone supports renewables.
Can I just come back with some information? I mean, we were asked to talk about coal.
Yes, I
mean, that's why we haven't gone into very much into renewables or into nuclear. There is going to be a nuclear debate, which I think is probably going to follow a similar kind of pattern to this, which is going to be on April 28th. And if people are interested, I can make sure they get further details of that. And that's being sort of hosted to have speakers pro and anti, and to actually unpack some of the issues around nuclear.
Great, thanks. Yes, we did ask the speakers to specifically keep to clean coal, because we can get a very, very wide range otherwise. Thank you. Hilary?
I think it's unfortunate that coal is being demonised in many people's eyes. The arguments that we heard from the environmental campaigners, for instance, that most coal production is done these days from open cast. That is not anything inherently to do with coal. It's because since the privatisation of the industry, nothing but nothing is allowed to get in the way of profit. And if you want to improve health and try and keep the lights on, one really useful thing you could do is to campaign to make it illegal to have open cast mining. Everyone does accept the health risks from open cast mining. But open cast is not essential as a part of mining coal. If it were mined via drifts or deep mining, you don't get a lot of those health problems that have been cited. So I think we need to be very clear about what the arguments are. There was also mention of poor conditions in some of the foreign countries that produce coal that we now buy. Again, if we go back to the politics of the Tory government, the privatisation and the loss of the strike by the NUM, that is all coming from that. It doesn't necessarily mean that that's an inherent part of coal and that you can't clean up some of those appalling practices which exist with child labour, slave labour conditions and so on. So I think what it's important to do is really keep to the issue about coal production and not to muddy the air, if I can mix them in metaphors, with information that's about poor practice rather than about what might be done. I have here something that's dear to my heart, because in 1983, before the strike, the NUN produced this campaign for coal pack in the lead up to the strike, and we had a booklet inside called New Ways of Using Coal. And in it, we were arguing for fluidized bed combustion, gasification, clean coal, and there was some basic information, which is possibly still true, in there about the benefits to the environment. So I'd like to assure people that you don't necessarily see coal and miners and the mining industry equals dirty, unhealthy and bad for the planet. The NUM was arguing and is still arguing for clean coal, and I think it's important for us to try and stick to the issues. For instance, why can't we have demand reduction and more renewables as well as clean coal? Those two, you know, those things are posed again as though they were against each other, when in fact what you need is an energy mix which has a proportion of a whole number of things, and there's argument about which proportion. But that doesn't stop you from thinking about reducing demand and developing green jobs as well. So I think the argument needs to be a lot more subtle and less black and white, coal dust versus cleanliness.
Right, thank you, Hilary. Chris?
A few things, really. I'm not sure that kind of everyone here is really necessarily aware of how serious I think the situation is. We've currently got 386 or a bit over that probably now parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. A safe level in order to retain ice at the poles, or specifically the North Pole, might be 340 parts per million. We're over that. It's not that we need to reduce CO2 emissions. We actually need to reduce CO2 levels in the atmosphere. We need to be pulling CO2 out of the atmosphere and capturing it, in addition to not emitting any more. And if we don't, we're not just facing, climate change. It might make it a bit warmer in Sheffield or something. We're probably facing the planet's sixth mass extinction, and we're probably looking at wiping out 90% of species on the planet, and probably some humans will survive because humans are very clever, but not as many as we've got now. And this isn't the kind of planet we want to be passing on to our grandchildren. So, I could go on at length about all these things, but I won't. I don't think nuclear is the answer. Nuclear, if you properly clean it up, some people have calculated that it possibly is actually a fossil fuel energy sink, that it takes more fossil fuel energy for the amount of energy it produces. So that's no answer. Carbon capture and storage, there's no guarantee it's actually going to stay underground. It seems very risky. We need to radically change direction of industrial. Well, it appears to me that we need a kind of a radical reevaluation of the whole nature of industrial civilization and a radical change of direction very quickly, if we're not to go down the road of planetary ecocide.
Thank you, Chris. Peggy?
I'm not supposed to stand up.
You can go on. My
name is Peggy Robinson, member of the Humanist Association. Having listened to the last speaker, I think very soon we're going back to my childhood, which is rather a long time ago. Living in a Welsh mining area, when I went to bed, I took a candle to go upstairs to bed. There was one oil lamp which hung from a hook in the ceiling over a large table, which is where you lived, other than when you slept. Now, are we going to go back to that? Are people prepared to go back to that? You see, we've had a lot of opposition to coal, Now, there again, I've lived in Yorkshire for a long time and been down rather a lot of pits, collieries in Yorkshire, and I've seen the conditions under which people were working. Those conditions have improved over the years quite a lot. We now know it's not a good thing for them to go, the miners to be working down there and breathing and all this stuff that was happening. That is being stopped, or at any rate improved upon. And you see, all the opposition across there is opposition. It's not suggesting how we can avoid going back to the oil lamp and the candles. That's assuming we want to go back. Or if we don't want to go back, then I suggest very sincerely that we've got to go into coal. And yes, we've got to insist, preferably through state control, state ownership, that coal mines are made clean, and also that nuclear... I know, yes, we've got the Greens saying, and I've got a lot of sympathy for Greens, I must confess. But what is the alternative? They're not offering us an alternative, you see. They say, oh, yes, yes, you can have bits of windmills. Look, let's face it, we've got windmills, quite a lot of them now on the sea or through the sea, on the land. They produce a bare trickle of what we need. It could be that they could be improved, but how long? Then we've got various other attempts, and they're producing a trickle, and that's great. Nobody's going to condemn those. But are we going to condemn our nation to all sorts of risks? What's happening now? We've got gas being brought by ship into Milford Haven. Now, that's coming from the Arabian countries. I know, I've been out there, I've seen it, I've seen this stuff. They suck it from the ground. Qatar's got the biggest gas field, they boast at any rate, in the world. That's sucked out the ground and then liquefied again, but in a different way, and put aboard ships. Think of any fellow who's just got a nice little bomb to drop on those ships. We're so surrounded by problems. We've also got gas fields going right across Europe to supply us. Well, we know what the risks are there. I think we've got no alternative. We've got to use nuclear. We've got to use coal, and we want to clean these up as for. We've got to tell people this has got to be done. Otherwise, we're going back to my childhood. It's your choice.
Thank you, Peggy. Mark.
Yes, going back to the world without electricity sounds a bit sounds a bit primitive, doesn't it? I'd just like to amplify something that Jenny said right at the start of her presentation. I get a bit frustrated at the way that the debate over energy always seems to be framed in terms of which energy mode is better than another. Because I have a feeling that whatever the solution is, that it's probably a mixture of them. But the one constraint that really can't be broken is that we have very clear guidance from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change about what the risks are of having too much CO2 in the atmosphere. We've got guidelines about what the acceptable limits are going to be if we're going to avoid serious damage to the climate. That's the one constraint we really got to focus on. And to me, that says one thing, which is we have to reduce our energy usage. I think that's got to be the overriding priority. And within that, it's going to mean radical changes to society, but I don't believe it means going back to a kind of a pre-industrial past. I'm sure there are ways of being more efficient with energy that would allow us to have something approaching a civilised lifestyle. But within that constraint, there's a debate to be had about how you generate energy to fill that the requirement. But these projections that we need more and more energy in the future, it doesn't really add up.
Thank you, Mark. Richard.
I'm reminded of the recent report, which is basically criticised the government. Basically says we want to be reaching our targets to the European community by 2020, because it's just not going to happen left to the market forces of the power industry and energy industry is on at the present time. Which leaves us the scenario where, let's say, the mice will be going out in 2015, and nothing is going to actually be done about it. We are going to be left with the over-reliance on coal, whether it's clean or unclean, and it'll probably be unclean, gas, which will be imported, and oil, which again will be increasingly imported. All of these are high carbon producers. And also, it leaves us open to the problem of energy security as well. Even if we sort of think about nuclear power, there's not enough materials worldwide at the moment to actually furnish all the nuclear projects that are being planned throughout the world. There's just not that the raw materials are just not there. And where they are, they're in Mongolia and China holds them. So we've got a few problems here. If anybody read the recent article in The Guardian, which was on Monday, on feed-in tariffs, and if you haven't, I suggest you actually read it. The new feed-in tariffs are actually sort of being introduced, which will allow individuals to put solar cells on the roofs, wind turbines in the back garden. There's about £8 billion being set aside for that. It's not going to produce very much energy, but there's great return of about 8% per year on that for anybody who wants to invest in that, and that's a good place to put your money at the moment. That £8 billion would probably be better put into sort of reducing food poverty, reducing the insulation, etc., and reducing the need for power and energy. But what this all comes down to is there's a lack of political will, and there's been a lack of political will for some time. And what we've got to think about is by 2020, there could be a minimum of 3 governments in this country by that stage, a minimum. And we're going to be in political turmoil for a few years to come anyway. No decisions are going to be made. And even if they are, it doesn't matter, because whoever's there at that point will just say, it's your boss's fault. And there'll be too much under the bridge just for anybody to actually even know. We've not won the political argument for clean power in this country, and that again is down to lack of political will. So unfortunately, coal's going to be with us, whether we like it or not, and it may not be clean. And just one final thing on that. Yes, I'll agree that the technology for clean coal is not yet proven. There is a problem with it, but what have you got left?
Thank you, Gillian.
I'm Gillian Creasy. Hi to Terry, I'm City Councillor. It's good to see you back, Mr.
Cullen.
I'm the Green Party. I'd like Terry to come back on the challenge about the kind of state of the technology. I hope there's a chance for the speakers to come back. It's just very, very stark contrast between Terry's description of what could happen, but it really didn't talk about the technology at all. And then the other two speakers really challenged that. So I would like Terry to have a chance to come back. For me, there's a question about a huge investment to change the way we do things, and whether it's kind of market forces or whether it's nationalisation. In a way, it doesn't really matter. That's a political decision. But society as a whole has to make a decision how to invest money to change the way we do things. And for me, I'd want to pick up what Peggy and Mark were talking about looking at the way we use energy and reducing our use. because, yeah, okay, we're going to have to meet this energy need. It probably is going to be a mix at the end of the day. But for me, the crucial thing is reducing our use. And I absolutely don't agree with Peggy that that means going back. It is Peggy, is it? I don't agree that that's going back to a lifestyle that we don't want. Actually, what I see is that we waste huge amounts of energy in our housing, so a lot of people are living in fuel poverty. Probably 500 people in Sheffield alone have died of cold in the last 3 months, excess winter deaths. So if we sorted that out, that would be a massive, massive investment, but it would actually improve people's lives hugely and reduce their fuel bills. Transport is about 20% of our emissions, not our carbon footprint, but our emissions in this city, in this country. If we actually move to having public transport, lots and lots of people who currently can't afford to have a car, can't afford to run it, would actually be able to move around the city and enjoy their lives a great deal more. Like the kind of relief when people get their free bus pass and they're actually able to move around and enjoy life in a different way. Food is another huge, it's not an emitter in this country because we import so much, but in global terms, food production is massive. So to me, it's about changing our lifestyles, which will actually make, you know, we could eat less meat, we'd all be healthier.
Can
you just, everything you look at.
We're actually trying to discuss clean, clean coal, so you can keep it talking.
Well, I suppose I'm just saying that in that case, you know, you don't need as much. And if we make a massive investment into clean coal, then we're failing to make investment into the changes that would mean we didn't need it.
Thanks, Julian. Sorry, just have to put you back, pull it into the point. Rob.
Yeah. Going right back to how you introduced this talk, saying, is this a talk for human society? I think it is, because there's some important questions here. I mean, I've heard a lot of inordinately bad science talked here tonight from all parties, I think, whether on the nuclear issue or on the renewables issue. And as humanists, we should be looking here for problems being solved on an evidence base rather than just on dogma, right? With that in mind, I'll move on very quickly. First of all, the coal issue. I do remember a paper, I mean, what was it, 80s, about fluidised bed being like a clean path to a safer future, when it was predicted that perhaps it could be a bridge to fusion power, which now looks to be like 50 years hence, probably. But about coal, I think it does have to be a part of an energy mix. But the thing that wasn't mentioned is the issue of the actual environmental impact as well of the desulfurisation process, which consumes a lot of the Peak District every year in terms of a chemical grade limestone. But having said that, against coal, I think the bad science came particularly out the second speaker on the anti brigade. Things like the quackery in things like those very small scale like health impact studies on the impacts of particulates, you know, are well known not to be true. I mean, every independent and large sample base which looks at that has, if you like, discredited all of those studies. Right. So with that in mind, you know, what's the actual way forward? What we didn't talk about really is the issue of base load, which was talked on very quickly, you know. Moving to renewables for baseload means you have to have a backup. Right. And sadly, using coal as a backup is really inefficient. To keep a lot of coal capacity running at a low level really heightens its inefficiency. Right. So on that basis, where does it take us? Now, we're going to have an energy shortage, we have a climate change issue. I think the only really way forward is to go for as clean as possible coal, very short term, you know, next 6-8 years. I think carbon capture is completely due to the emperor's new clothes. I think it's the last ditch attempt to save an old industry. However, I mean, you're not in agreement with that side of the argument, but I think the answer has to be renewables backed up with nuclear. The nuclear waste issue isn't what it used to be. You know, new design plant produces about 4% the level of waste as the original, you know, 1950s ones did. And as for the long-term supply of material, I mean, Australia has huge untapped fields of uranium, you know, which are going to be opened up over the next 20-30 years. So I suppose I'm going to disagree with everybody in here. I think that it's really important that we put all the measures in place to get as much renewable as place in place as quick as possible, even though there's public opposition to it, huge public opposition to it. Coal has to play a short-term bridge, and in the long term has to be renewables and nuclear.
Well, thanks for a troublemaker.
Yeah.
Bloody humanist, as usual. You.
Joan.
I don't hear it. Joan.
Well, first I'd just like to thank the Humanist Society. Obviously, this is a very important debate, particularly in South Yorkshire. And, you know, there's a history there, and that's important. So with great respect, in a way, I'd like to kind of draw you back to one of Jenny's slides, which is about how much fossil fuel there is left. And there's masses of coal, really. So we could... It's easy for us to destroy the planet in a way. There's plenty of fossil fuel left there. And to that, we spent a long time with Kyoto working on emissions and reducing emissions. And actually that has failed. So we've carried on polluting and we haven't met those targets at all worldwide, those countries that were aiming for that. And a completely different way of approaching that is to look at supply. So instead of measuring the emissions, you look at the supplies of oil and gas and coal, and it has been calculated how much we're able to use, and it's it's a limited amount. I think we have to stick there really, and the coal fields that are already open, I guess they will stay open for that kind of that brief transition of 5 or 10 years. But to open new ones and to expand is foolish, because then, you know, we can't control the emissions. If we dig it up, it will be burnt, and then there are emissions, and it stays in the atmosphere a long time, 100 to 200 years. So, and yeah, just sorry, but a point. I mean, Britain actually has contributed the most CO2 because we've been doing it for. We started the Industrial Revolution, and we've been doing it for so long that we, overall, just at this moment, we've emitted the most. So we have that responsibility, I think, to the rest of the world to set an example. And although we're a small emitter now, we need to show that we can say we've got to keep our fossil fuel in the ground.
Thank you. I've got four speakers left, two of whom have spoken before. Is there anyone who hasn't spoken before who would like to make a point?
Dave, would it be possible to come back on a point?
Yes, if that's okay. Yes, just briefly. I've got you down for next.
Because, just to pull together a couple of things, but I'm sorry if there has been poor science in what we've said. That's certainly not the intention. And I would love to know what is incorrect, and to test that out and to check that out, because I mean, it is very much my understanding of why we were talking to the humanists about coal, is that we would want to take a view which is actually based, as you say, in evidence and based in science, and not that's based on fantasy or based on wishful thinking. I want to pull you back to the slides that I showed from Peter Vibar.
Do you want to cover this in your summing up at the end? Unless it's specific.
I think it might inform what was said, because just to clarify that, and it's a tricky thing to explain, perhaps without the graphs there. But there was one where I was showing you the difference between the dark green blocks. But what that was showing, what for people who have questioned that, was a mix of energy use. But it was showing different scenarios, really, in terms of where we put our investment, where we put our science, what we do with our time and our energy. And somebody earlier said we should do both, but the fact is that within there's a likelihood that we won't do everything. We will choose, we'll make those choices, which other speakers have said is not a we're not necessarily made the right choices, and there are consequences. And the only thing that CCS is offering is something that in 2030 gives us more energy. It doesn't actually solve our climate change problem in the timescale that we need to change it.
Thanks. Ken.
Ken from Sheffield District Labour Party and chair of Sheffield Corporate Party. There's one fact that appears from the way the discussion's gone, that this is a British problem. It's an international problem, and I know that you all know that, but we tended to talk about it in a parochial sense. We're in the midst of a revolution, yet at the same time, there's a limit being set by nature, which we've got time to act within, and we don't know exactly what that time limit is. Napoleon, who wasn't the wisest man on the planet at any time, but he said this, and he was referring to China: let the sleeping giant sleep, for if he awakes, he will shake the world. He's shaking the world. And the reality is that everybody on the planet wants to live at the same level that we do. To consume in the way that we've consumed, to live as we've lived. The reality is, brothers and sisters, the planet cannot afford it. If everybody wanted to live at the same standard of living that we've got, we would need another six planets. And that's the stark reality. So really, in one way, the question of energy is a side issue. The growth of population is a major issue which impacts upon every other decision. And frankly speaking, and I'm speaking here as an individual, not as a member of a political organisation, but I've identified that I am one. I seriously believe that we've been let down by the politicians of all parties because of pragmatism. They've taken opportunities as they come along and seized the opportunity in order to win an election, in order to look good, rather than thinking in terms of the planet and the long-term consequences. There's a consequence of that. We're up to there in the shit.
Thanks, Ken.
And we're going to have a great deal of difficulty in getting out of it.
Thanks, Ken. You're next.
Yeah, and my name is Peter Garber, Green Party. You spoke, as you were introducing the discussion part, about timescales, and I think timescales are really, really important here. We've spoken about clean coal with carbon capture and storage. We've spoken, some of us at more length than others, about nuclear. And obviously, with Jenny, we've spoken about renewables. The timescales that we've got aren't very long. We have to start reducing the output of carbon into the atmosphere now, as soon as possible. We aren't doing it. Joan says the Kyoto Accords haven't been kept to. We aren't reducing our output. But it has to start now if we are to meet that 25% chance of not going above 2 degrees higher by 2050. We have to start now. If we put our faith in clean coal, that won't come online. Well, we've heard various figures, 2025, 2030, 2040. We've heard various figures. That will not reduce our carbon output. If we rely to any great degree on the nuclear industry, and at the moment I think they provide about 5%, 10%, something like that of our electricity. If we rely on the nuclear industry, that means we start building them now and they will come online 2020, Maybe a little earlier, depending on how fast they can do it. Mind you, I'm worried about the speed they build these things. It might probably, more hasteless speed. So we won't be reducing our output for 10 years with nuclear. Probably. So we have to put our faith, and it may be faith, it may be no more than faith, but we have to do it. We have to put our faith in doing two things and doing them well. And that is reducing demand, and that doesn't mean we use, we turn off the TV for 10 hours a day or whatever it is. It means insulating our buildings, not just our private buildings, but our public buildings, making sure that all our buildings are as carbon neutral as we can make them, making sure that all new buildings that we put up are carbon neutral. That is perfectly possible. It has been done, and it can be done. So that's the one thing we have to do. And the second thing is we have to very, very quickly expand our network of renewable energies. And that doesn't mean just wind. That doesn't mean just solar. It doesn't mean just biomass. There are a whole raft of different technologies that we can use, and they're all, some are more advanced than others, some are still in their infancy. Tidal energy is still not proven to be a viable thing. Wind energy is. Solar, the massive solar arrays, for example, there's one in Spain, I think there's one in Kuwait, or is it Qatar, which are producing huge amounts of electricity. We can do this and pipe the electricity around the planet. Theoretically, it hasn't been done, so we don't know.
Exactly.
No, but if we don't, we will never find out. So we have to do this now and not put our faith in these huge, industrial complexes which have a lot of political power behind them and which want to make sure that they hang on to that political power.
I'm going to be a bit naughty as the chair. Isn't a great big solar array in Qatar an industrial complex?
Could easily be.
Just.
No.
I just like to be awkward. I'm not nervous to see. I have got you next. We then have two speakers who have spoken before. I am going to call them, but I'm going to ask them to be very, very brief. Okay? You.
Okay, the last speaker did go through some of the things that I was going to go through, so I won't do that. But I want to focus on the climate science again, because it's really important. We're at 386 parts per million carbon dioxide. The 350 mark, what might be safe. So we have to take carbon dioxide out, like Chris said. So all that stuff about the increasing, the corporate profit mongers and the consumer society projecting a sort of business as usual, we can increase. They're selling us more gadgets that we don't really need. Our well-being and our happiness doesn't depend on having this stuff. What we do need to do is to reduce our energy consumption. Insulation's been talked about, reduction in a whole lot of other areas, nationalising and getting more public transport and all that sort of stuff. But there are really, really close, we're really close to tipping points on the planet that will make positive feedback come on, and that means that the increase in carbon in the atmosphere will go out of our hands, out of human hands. It will increase carbon sinks at the moment, like the oceans and the soil, will become sources. They'll start emitting carbon dioxide. So we have to really reduce very quickly our carbon dioxide. We have to have negative carbon rather than putting stuff out into the atmosphere. And it's really ironic, but the poorest people on Earth, the ones who have put the least carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, will be suffering the most. The third world, the global south, are going to have the most trauma. So it's really, we have a responsibility to be very fast in our reduction. So clean coal is not going to be a solution. Insulation may have an effect, but demand reduction is going to be really important.
Just
Right, Tony, briefly, please.
Right, I'll try and be as brief as I can. By the gentleman in the front here in the red sweatshirt, red thing, said, I forgot his name, Peter, about a lot of these things are political, which they are, and expanding that slightly, what causes problem is capitalism raping the planet. And until something is done to constrain capitalism, then the problem isn't really going to be solved. And then, but to go up, I mean, I live in a house that's no cavities, it's double brick wall, no cavities. Can't get a grant to insulate the walls from the inside, which is what Jenny said about insulating properties. That's because the government isn't interested. Again, that's a political issue. They're not interested. It doesn't make them look good. The other thing is, we've got the longest and the windiest coastline in Europe. We ought to put in thousands of wind turbines in the sea. And by doing that, we could generate a tremendous amount of electricity. And to go back to insulation again, I've got a caravan. And what you realise when you live in a caravan is how efficient a caravan is at insulation. And the walls are only about 1.5 feet. So surely buildings can be insulated efficiently as well. So those, I know it's a hot spot, but that's more or less the points I'm going to make.
Thanks, Tony. Matt?
Just to follow up briefly on Rob about how humanists are supposed to be evidence-based. As a stereotypical sandal-wearing, bike-riding vegetarian, up until 5 years ago, I was a knee-jerk anti-nuclear guy like many other people. Until I got into a debate with a physicist from Sheffield University. He absolutely destroyed every single one of my just lazily laid out kind of zeitgeist kind of anti-nuclear arguments. So I went into research and thought, right, I'm going to get this guy. I'm going to, you know, prove him wrong. And I had to go back the next week and tell him, no, he was right, and I'd been wrong. When you look at the evidence, nuclear is not the demon it's so often depicted as in green circles. You've really got to look at the evidence, and you'll see it's so different from what just the general dialogue in green circles would you lead you to believe. And just respond to the guy, Peter. It's so ironic again to hear somebody going on about timelines of things being brought in and how we've not to make an act of faith in nuclear or coal, whilst advocating we put our faith in technologies which he conceded in his little talk haven't even been developed yet and are still being developed. That is the ultimate act of faith. We're saying we're not going to invest in this proven clean technology which works now, which provides 90% of France's energy. We're instead going to put our faith in technologies which we haven't even got yet.
Thank you.
Can
you come back on that in the bar? I'm afraid we do have to give our speakers a chance to sum up, and I'm just bringing in the audience now. Thank you very much to everyone in the audience, because I think that's been a really useful set of contributions. I found a lot of really interesting stuff in that. I'm going to take the summing up in the reverse order of the speaking, if that's okay. So if you'd like to have 5 minutes max, and similarly 5 minutes max for you, and I'm going to do you two first, and then Terry. Is that okay? Thank you.
Okay, so to summarise, I agree with an awful lot of what people up on the floor have said about reduction. We have to reduce our consumption, and probably the lights are going to go off, and that will be the kick that we need to get real about the lifestyle that we can sustain. We can't live on this planet in the way that we do. We live on a finite planet. We cannot continue to exploit the resources in this way. We're going to have to reduce our consumption. We're not going to go back to the dark ages that this lady was, we're not going to move backwards. We're going to move forwards into society that has to be juster. We have to talk about climate justice for the world's poor, for the nation's poor. That's what matters. Clean coal isn't going to come in time. It's just a business as usual approach. The corporations and the governments can continue as they are at present, and ignore the fact that we're moving fast towards catastrophe. We have to reduce. That's the most important thing that we have to do. It's been mentioned a couple of times that we're not the only people in this planet who are producing the CO2, that other nations seek the quality of life that we have here. However, China in 1 year has managed to install as much renewables as we have ever in this country. The technology for renewables does exist, but we haven't been investing in it in the way that other countries have, the way that countries like Denmark have. So tidal power does offer predictable energy generation. The tides come in, they go out. It's predictable. Other renewables are not as predictable, but with combining energy reduction through actually using less and also through energy saving methods, we can manage to continue to produce enough energy to get by, not enough energy for our lavish lifestyles. So clean coal is not the answer. We have to produce.
Thank you. And thanks, Chair, and to you people for listening and giving Kyle a chance. And obviously I've listened to what you've got to say and various degrees, and it just goes to prove one thing, is that there are facts and statistics all over the place. You can make them say whatever you want, wherever you want. Some of the facts are not up for debate, are they? We all know where we are at this situation in time and the things that we need to address. The first thing I'd like to address is, if you want a nuclear power station, go to Sellafield and they'll have one tomorrow. Go to Calder Hall, they'll have one tomorrow. If you want to put a new power station up, go to Egborough, go to Drax, go to Ferrybridge, they'll have one tomorrow. Because that is where the people will say, hear me. Go and try and put some windmills up tomorrow, you've no chance. They'll be planning onshore, off, big arguments, because they're not established as yet, and I appreciate there is a place for them in the energy mix. Why aren't they in the energy mix? Because Britain, part of the G7, and unfortunately we lose the argument every time, because we are all part of a car boot society. Cheapest is best with us. If we had this attitude with the Victorian, we'd have nothing in this country, absolutely nothing. And every politician ought to look at themselves in the eyes and say, where is our investment in this country? None whatsoever. Give me one major investment. The only thing we've had invested is up and down the motorways. We're having 4 lanes. That's the way forward with this country. There is no... We accept that we've got to travel, but we'll put another lane in. But there's got to have somebody inside of it. Julian raised the question about public transport. Go anywhere, people will tell you where they've invested in public transport, you've seen an increase. Why can't we have that investment? Because we should be world leaders. And I think it was Joan that said about, we was the biggest thing. We are. How can we turn around to China, to India? You shouldn't be increasing as fast as you are. You shouldn't have what we have. We should be world leaders. And that is where clean coal comes in. It is the new kid on the block. It is the way forward. We've heard all sorts. Where we're losing the argument is, go and ask some of the people who've put these power reducing light bulbs in. They've took them out next to that, can't see. I'm never going to get a chance. It's to that, can't see, no kid. And throw it out of way. Typical narrow-minded arguments that we don't see overall. And what we've got to look at is where the technology is working. And the challenge from Gillian at the back was, where's challenging the technology? Just go to Dukeson Babcock, go and look on their website. Norway up and running. I think it's Germany up and running. And I lose the one. There's another one in Europe that's up and running. Small actual contained parts where they are actually working with CCS now. And they're where they're going to work. Act of faith, clean coal. The energy policy is an act of faith that we've got in this, because we have just said totally that we believe in a sustainable, renewable way forward. There's a place for nuclear, there's a place for coal, there's a place for oil and gas, and there is a place for renewables. But if you think that you're going to replace base load, either in this country or globally, with any other fuel than coal at this moment in time, forget it. It ain't there. Why it ain't there? Because there ain't the political will there. What we have to do at this moment in time is accept what we're using around the core, around the world, accept the thirst for power that's there, that we should be market leaders, we should accept the technology. We've had our beauty parade, as we've called it. We've had 4 bidders that have announced the winners of the competition that's going to build our small CCS, and a way forward we'll go. Pathetic. It's a step in the right direction, but it's pathetic because we have got, by 2015, power stations will be closing because they haven't met their emission targets, their coal burn will be up, and then people will be up in arms in this country shouting that they demand, and in fact we should have more discussions about this around the whole world, but I must target one issue that was raised by Jenny and Anne, COPD. COPD has been a massive thing in our industry, there is no doubt about it, but let me tell you, the massive raises that were shown on there are not true, because particulates, you can get particulate within the first 6 months of working in a mine, and you might be in 30 years, and touch wood, you might never get it. So it's unfortunate the way that COPD is looked around, but the only way forward is not surface mining, it's deep mines. Methane produced by that is now being captured and used to produce electricity around this world. And the overall concepts of clean coal technologies, we have to accept first of all where we have got a short and medium term thing, because I'm telling you now, at one stage we'll be walking around and there'll be a windmill bolted next to everybody's satellite dish, and that's the way forward that we'll go in this country. Thank you for your time.
Well, I hope everyone has found that useful. By the way, I do actually think we do need industrial scale solar panels, and not microscale solar panels. But I do think they are industrial scale, and we have to recognise that. Right, before we go, first of all, the next meeting is going to be about the Samaritans, the work of the Samaritans. We have three speakers. You will have seen a flyer. If you haven't had a flyer, there are some over there. We have three speakers from the Samaritans. I've forgotten their names, I'm afraid. No surnames, because they don't give a full identity because of the nature of the work. I think that could be very interesting. Over here, you'll find there is a list you can sign on. If you leave your email address, and that's all we really need, just your email address,